According to the Wall Street Journal, consumers are borrowing a little more again. We'll find out what this could mean for our credit habits in America. Lewis Hyman is our guest now. He's an assistant professor at Cornell University and the author of Debtor Nation. Lewis, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, as we launch into this big shopping weekend and the run-up to Christmas, how are Americans feeling about taking on debt these days?
Americans are very debt avoidant these days. If you look at the numbers, it's very clear that people are borrowing less than they did certainly during the run-up to the financial crisis, and people are looking for alternatives like layaway.
And I assume that it's because of that recession everybody's a little gun-shy about new debt?
People are gun-shy, and it's not just the borrowers, it's also the lenders. That if you look at the numbers, you can see that there is just very little money coming out for people to borrow in the way that they had, especially on credit cards.
I thought I'd heard that might be softening up. I mean, in the pre-recession times, the joke was that if you had a pulse, you could get a mortgage and 20 credit cards and a car loan. Then it was, you know, blood from a stone. Things aren't loosening up from the lender's perspective?
They're loosening up a little bit, especially on securitized non-revolving loans, like house loans and things like that, or car loans. But if you actually look at the numbers, it's pretty anemic. The number of dollars increasing is near zero, plus or minus a billion, you know, for at the level of the economy that actually is near zero. So thinking about that way, it's pretty substantial how things are not changing.
Well, I can see a good read on that and a bad read. The good read is we aren't going to be getting ourselves in over our heads with easy debt. The bad read is if we can't borrow money as easily, we can't buy stuff and boost the economy in this slow recovery. Is there some truth on both sides of that?
And there's another truth as well. I think there's truth on both of those sides, but there's another truth that the money is also not being lent into businesses. So that, you know, it wouldn't be so bad if they said, hey, we're not going to lend you money to go shopping today as long as the money were being invested in, you know, new factories or businesses, something that produced jobs. But it's mostly that these banks are just sitting on the money, which doesn't help anybody at all.
What would it take for financial institutions to start lending money again?
Well, I think it's about creating safety and creating incentives, not just to invest in, you know, big projects like green technology or things like that, but even just small businesses. I think the government could do a lot towards creating standards for investing in small businesses, just like they have done with houses. Of course, houses are all of a wide variety of shapes and sizes, but you can create a few different qualities of a house, standards for houses, that allow people to lend on them. You know, that someone can buy a mortgage for a house in Texas or Wisconsin and have the money come from New York is a pretty amazing thing.
So a lot of people have always talked about the American dream, often centering around the house. I've heard rumblings lately that the new American dream is to be debt-free or close to. Do you see that kind of big picture change?
I think that would be an amazing shift to have us focus more on our solvency and financial capacity than on things. But I think for a lot of Americans, it's just not possible. I mean, the recovery has largely gone to the top 1%. And, you know, for everybody else who's not part of that, their lives are just as unstable, their paychecks uncertain as ever before. And I think the other American dream isn't just being out of debt, but being feeling like you have a good job or even a small business that would provide you enough to live off of.
I want to take a step back from what's going on today. I know you've traced the rise of debt as part of United States culture and capitalism. How did we switch from an era where credit was for the businesses you were talking about? I'll lend you money to build that new factory, or I'll buy a bond in your new business, to debt being something that goes on the consumer side?
Yeah, it's a really big question. It's a long process, and I've written two books about it, but I'll try and summarize it in one sentence. the answer is that it became more profitable to invest in a dollar of consumer credit than a dollar of business investment. And this began to happen in the 1960s when large corporations like General Electric began to realize they could make more money off of financing the goods that they made than in the manufacturing of goods that they made. This has big ramifications because it's exactly this moment when you begin to see our largest corporations begin to shift their assets out of producing, out of factories and into finance. And what this does is it produces lots of money for these corporations, but it doesn't produce the good jobs that made it possible to buy those goods, to pay back those goods. And so in this moment from the 70s to now, we have a complete stagnation of American income, and yet our economy keeps growing. And that gap between what we're paid and what we spend is made possible by debt. And so in the post-war period, if the 1% paid the 99% in wages, after 1970, they just lent them money.
I remember a quote somewhere about General Motors, somebody saying, "We used to be an auto company that happened to loan money. Now we're a lending institution that happens to make cars." Is that a common for a lot of big American corporations?
That's exactly right. So if you look at the biggest companies like General Motors or General Electric, these companies that we think of as making things, they begin to shift their resources into lending money. And for good reason, that it just becomes more profitable because of increasing automation and globalization and competition. But yet it has very dire ramifications. And so on the one hand, it's understandable why they did it, but it's also from a failure of imagination. So that, we don't have those crazy futuristic kinds of products that we all imagine we would have, partially because that money went into finance and not into manufacturing.
Interesting. So was there a brain drain, too? I hear sometimes the smartest people who used to go into science and engineering now go into the financial industry. Is that something that's stifling American innovation?
Absolutely. That's absolutely stifling American innovation, that all the smartest people go into management consulting and investment banking and things like that when, in the post-war, they would have gone to work at Bell Labs. Of course, Bell Labs, isn't quite the center of things, the hotbed for where smart people go anymore. And it's because there's just big money. I mean, people who are scientists are as rational as the rest of us, and the choice between $60,000 a year or $600,000 a year is a pretty easy choice. But it's had big ramifications, not just for those scientists, but for the economy as a whole, which we need to think about in terms of creating incentives for research and development.
Yeah, what kind of incentive turns that around? You said, if you're making exponentially more money working at a financial outfit on Wall Street, how do you get people back into those more innovative professions?
Well, the easiest way would just be to create tax incentives for large corporations to invest in R&D and to help them focus on long-term development rather than short-term profit. But that's a very hard shift in our era of shareholder value to get people to think about the long-term over the short-term. The short-term always wins out.
Well, I want to talk about something else happening over the weekend now. A lot of people will be using their credit cards, even if it's hard to get new ones. How did we get credit cards? Where did those come from? They're a fairly, in the scope of human history, recent invention.
Sure. Credit cards come out of the late 1950s. There's some sort of many experiments with credit cards before that, but the idea of being able to have a card that you could use anywhere, that you were able to go to any shop and buy anything on, is a very recent phenomena. And it really comes out of the 1960s. And it's real driver is the Bank of America, who is able in California to create a network of both customers and merchants who accept these cards. Before then, credit was very much tied to particular stores and retailers. And that function of offering credit was not something that was done through banks or through larger markets. It was done through particular stores. And so from the 50s, the 60s, it begins to expand. But it really takes off in the 1980s. It takes off in the 1980s as those interest rates pop up in the Volcker years, but they stay up for credit cards. And then with securitization, people are able to offer much more credit than ever before in the 1990s.
And it seems like the technology, the infrastructure, must have made it much easier and faster to use those credit cards. And did that lead to a mushrooming of the use of those?
Absolutely. You can't have widespread credit cards without point-of-sale technology. And so as they're better able to track purchases, as they're better able to generate credit reporting for individuals, banks are able to extend more and more credit to customers.
So let's look at the long run again. I kind of think of the economy as maybe boom and bust, or you get a bubble where everybody's living a little high on the hog, and then it bursts and it goes down. Are we going to see that cycle again where we have a lot of credit available to us once more, and then we overextend ourselves and have another repeat of 2008?
It doesn't seem like anything is going to stop that from happening. This sort of long-term reason for these crises that seem to be happening more and more often after 1980 are really about inequality, that the money is generated by capitalism, which is incredibly productive, and that money has to be invested somewhere. And because people at the bottom can't buy the things without credit, it gets invested in debt. And then, but eventually the debts come due and people can't pay them. And voila, here's another crisis, whether it's the SNL crisis or today, these things keep happening again and again until we figure out a way to make capitalism work for people at the bottom as well as it does for the top. These crises are going to keep happening. And of course, the good thing as a historian, I like to remind people, is that we did figure this out before. In after World War II, for about 30 years, we managed to balance growth and inequality in the economy, which allowed broad prosperity for most of America.
When we're talking about those people at the bottom you just mentioned, there's a big financial self-help industry telling people how to get out of debt, cut their spending, that sort of thing. Do you think there's something to that, or does there need to be more of a structural solution to their problems?
Well, I think it's good to budget one's income, but there's also, we need to recognize at the sort of structural level that budgets can control us, but they can't control the world we live in. So that even if you're living within your means, if you lose your job, suddenly everything falls apart. And for most people who are living paycheck to paycheck or near to that, no matter how good they are at shopping at the grocery store, they're still going to come up very short if things fall apart. And it's that insecurity of the labor market today that is very difficult for many Americans, that while large corporations can shoulder risk and uncertainty by, you know, buying futures contracts and hedging their risk and such, ordinary folks can't do that. Ordinary folks just want stable lives. And that is a structural problem that we need to address in the economy.
All right, Lewis, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
That was Lewis Hyman. He's assistant professor at Cornell University, the author of Debtor Nation, The History of America in Red Ink.